Welcome to the Future of Love teleseries presented by the Integral Spiritual Experience, Integral Life, and iEvolve Global Practice Community. The Future of Love dialogues continue this week with a second dialogue between Andrew Cohen and Dr. Mark Gaffney. Andrew is an American spiritual teacher and visionary and the founder of Enlightened Next and the editor-in-chief of Enlightened Next magazine. Mark is a gifted world spirituality teacher and core founder of iEvolve. In their dialogue, Andrew and Mark will talk about transforming your relationship into an expression of the evolutionary impulse, awakening into your fullest authentic self, and learning how your relationships might emerge as an expression of your fully awakened uniqueness. It is with much pleasure we present Andrew Cohen with Dr. Mark Gaffney.
Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi, I am wonderful. And I want to thank everyone. We got quite a lot of response and wonderful response on many nuanced and different levels to Andrew's and my previous dialogue in this Future of Love series, which was really about self-love, which is self-perception. When you go into the self, what do you find at its highest levels, authentic self versus unique self? And we found actually that both share a great common context. Both are about evolution beyond ego, and both say that the evolution beyond ego doesn't end with a classical enlightenment realization that you're part of the one, but there's actually an awakened impersonal, we'll call it impersonal, right, call, right, to action, which is the fully embodied expression of the evolutionary impulse in what, for the sake of this dialogue, right, in peace and harmony, we'll call the authentic unique self. Does that sound fair?
Well, that's part of a continuing discussion, I guess.
A continuing conversation. So today, we're here to talk about relationships. And I think, Andrew, the context for our discussions, as I was thinking about it this morning, has always been that I'm coming from, in my kind of deepest lineage place, my deepest, you know, depth structure, as opposed to surface structure, from some sense of the evolutionary context of Kabbalah, which is, as I wrote many years ago, a kind of evolutionary mysticism, right? And you're coming from the space of your realization, the space of your study, right, combined together, both we share the integral worlds. You were particularly deep in Aurobindo. I know he was a formative influence for you. And often we find surprisingly, right, as you've evolved your own original thought, and as I've gone my way, we find surprisingly to our delight that, you know, as evolutionary brothers, the context of the evolutionary mysticism of Kabbalah and the context that you're unfolding and evolving in the world today often have something to say to each other and actually share, right, a perspective that's actually exciting and compelling, and unlike, you know, in the academy, when someone overlaps with you and you're kind of, oh my God, your ego's in trouble because, you know, they might write my paper and I might not get tenure, when in the world of spirit we see common patterns or common strains, each uniquely expressed, we're actually delighted because we know that we're kind of running into kind of a lodestone of truth. So perhaps that will happen today in the world of relationships and perhaps not. But we'll see how it emerges. So let me just begin by offering something and then turn it over to you, Andrew. When we talk about relationships, romantic, sexual, engagements, relationships in their broadest context, right, the Kabbalist would say that a relationship, right, is about tikkun, right, T-I-K-K-U-N, a word that you know well, right, and tikkun is the Hebrew word, which is literally translated as healing, fixing, repair. My friend and Andrew's and my colleague Michael Lerner runs a magazine by that name. But actually, if you look at the original Kabbalah, and Andrew and I discussed this in Israel several years ago, the word tikkun actually means, as Cook explains it, to evolve, right? It's got an evolutionary impulse to it, right? Tikkun means that when I come together with you, right, in a relationship, we're doing it because we have a shared tikkun. That's how Luria says it. Right, you come together, your soulmate's not that person who's going to passionately redeem you from misery magically, but you come together with a person with whom you share, right, an obligation to a kind of shared tikkun, a shared fixing, healing, evolving that you can only do together, which of course, right, if that would come online in a dramatic way, then the future of love, our topic, would be very different. So I offer that Kabbalistic insight which has you know, guided me, right, in understanding and teaching this in my life as a kind of starting point, and turn to you, Andrew, and your teaching, right, with great delight, because your teaching is deep and vast and profound, right, to really hear and how you begin to approach this. And from that place, we will, as we discussed about a week back online, will spontaneously emerge to where we go.
Thank you, Mark. So we're speaking about
relationships
in the largest sense, but I presume that we are within that context going to be focusing on the romantic and sexual relationship within the context of relationship?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I think that we agree, and before we get into the particulars of the kind of romantic and sexual dimension of relatedness and relationships within this newly emerging evolutionary context, it became apparent to me, I've been teaching for almost 25 years, for 24 plus years, it became apparent to me pretty soon after I became a spiritual teacher that actually it's the nature of our relationships with each other and the potential depth, intimacy, and profundity of our relationships is the way that, to use a theological term, it's the way that God or spirit actually manifests and enters into the world of time and space. So it's in the context of human relatedness through human relationships that spirit, or what we could call God, or the non-dual absolute, actually enters into the world. So the nature and the depth and the quality of our relationships means a lot and has great significance for those of us who are actually interested in the evolution of consciousness, yeah, interested in the evolution of culture, are interested in the awakening of enlightened awareness. And I often, I think that one telltale sign for any of us as individuals in terms of how profound is our awakening, what is the nature of our spiritual attainment, how deep is it really, how much spiritual meaning and significance and relevance it has, I think can easily be found and seen objectively. When we look at how profound is the nature of our relationships with other human beings, and so that's the kind of just a general beginning here, is that relationship and the nature of relationship for all of us who are interested in the evolution of consciousness and culture and an awakening to enlightened awareness, the question of the significance of relationship and relationships and how deep and profound they are means everything. It's not a side matter. It's not a small thing. I think that relationship and the nature of our relationships and the evolution of the depth and the profundity of our relationships actually means everything. In relationship to the whole notion of what spiritual awakening is all about. So that being said, within the context of the romantic and sexual relationship, I have a fairly, to use one of your favorite words, unique a perspective on this particular area.
I hope it's also authentic.
No, definitely. touche. <Okay. laughs> that was good. Yeah, unique and authentic. It's authentic for sure, and how unique it is, I guess, remains to be seen. But I feel, of course, as you're well aware, that I'm looking more and more at the whole issue of spiritual awakening, the awakening to consciousness, within at the same time looking at the evolution of culture as it affects the self, because each and every one of us, as we are unique individuals, we also are expressions of culture, of culture hopefully evolving. So mm-hmm. as unique individuals, the self that we are and the structures that make up the self that we are all really expressions of our own cultural heritage, and this is a very big proportion of who we are as unique individuals is really largely an expression of the cultural values, beliefs, and perspectives that we have grown up within, and also have chosen to identify as we have become self-aware adults. So, how this relates to this particular conversation is that, as we know, in the postmodern era, you and I both have, you know, grew up in the postmodern era, and that, mm-hmm. of course, started sometime in the early 60s, and in many, and we're still in it. This is a time when secularism, has largely taken over, which means, you know, we've taken a leap from a traditional worldview where there was a religious and spiritual context for the human experience, and then with modernism that was really thrown up into question, and with postmodernism that was completely rejected, and there was the rebellion against and the rejection of an outdated religious worldview that did provide context for human experience, including the romantic and sexual relationship. So with modernism and then with the postmodern revolution, the individuals like ourselves, individuals found, if there are many people like us who found themselves, were among the group of what I call the luckiest people that have ever been born, because mm-hmm. we are more educated, relatively speaking, more wealthy, and more privileged, and have more freedoms, you know, than any human beings that have ever existed in the history of human civilization. And at the same time, we find ourselves in a very particular time in cultural evolution where on an individual level we are highly cognitive, we're very sophisticated, and we have really the freedom more or less to do as we please. But the context, in other words, how to translate, how to locate really the self within the context of larger culture is very, very difficult for us because we live in a culture of the individual, and it's within this context when there is no larger meta context, there's no larger religious context, that most individuals from our generation and also our children's generation and generations, The place in which, for most people, intimacy and connection and connectedness is found is within the romantic and sexual embrace. Right. And so for our generation and our children's generation, because we live in a largely, I'm making a generalization here, but largely a secular context, because of the secular context we live in, we find that the ultimate reference point for intimacy and for connectedness is through the romantic and sexual embrace. And so in this secular cultural context, what is held as most sacred and the place of the ultimate refuge for that which is sacred and that which is most important, whether it's stated explicitly or not, implicitly, it's within the bond of the romantic and sexual relationship. So the significance of the romantic and sexual relationship has been given a lot of importance in our culture because it's
worth saying maybe just for a moment. I mean, we've killed all of the gods except for Aphrodite, and that's really what's happened. All the gods have been dethroned. All the gods have been killed. We've just left Aphrodite up there, and we kneel only at her altar, and so therefore she's not contextualized by any of the other gods.
Precisely, in a kind of
Greek sense. And whenever you take one god, right, and you make that god the god, right, when you ever take a part, you know, as we know from the larger, you know, theories and understandings of our own lives and theories of life, you take a part and you make it into a whole. Right, you pathologize, right? You get a kind of cancer in the body politic. You know, an extremist is a person who has a good value, but they can never have too much of that value, right? Because they've taken that value out of context. So when only Aphrodite reigns, right, so then we get this kind of very, very absurd situation, which is the one that you're actually in process of describing. So please, you know, go the next step. But I just wanted to set that context for us so people can actually feel that. We kneel at the altar of only one God today, Aphrodite.
That's very well put, and that's really the whole point of everything I've been trying to say and to put into context. So, as I was teaching and beginning to think about a lot of these things, I realized that consciously or unconsciously, I was observing many people, many adults, looking to the romantic and sexual embrace and the romantic and sexual union. They were looking to that with expectations of completion, wholeness, fulfillment that really couldn't be found. I felt in such a ultimately limited context, because the romantic and sexual domain has been a very important part of the human experience. I mean, principally because, of course, it's the realm of procreation, and it's also a place where it's possible to experience a great deal of pleasure and a certain intensity of pleasure, and of course vulnerability, of kind of human vulnerability. So for many of these reasons, I've been given a lot of significance. But of course, with postmodernity, and of course with the emergence of the birth control pill, a lot of the traditional structures in which the sexual activity took place really began to open up, and of course there was a sexual revolution, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the ability to have many more partners for both men and women entered into a picture. And I began to observe, when I was younger, I began to see this, within myself. But I started to begin to see the impersonal nature of sexual desire. I began to see that what I called the promise of perfection began to emerge, which is that this particular desire, desire is very intense. It's one of the strongest desires that there is, and that we're biologically programmed to be completely overwhelmed and seduced by its promise. And what I started to notice in my own experience, and I was observing it in others, is that the promise of perfection, which is inherent in the sexual impulse, is a promise that is rarely fulfilled truthfully. In other words, there's the promise of perfection. It's a utopian promise. It's almost like a spiritual promise. Right. It's a utopian promise. And, of course, at its best, it's glorious and ecstatic, right, and intoxicating and wonderful, and we experience intense pleasure and intense intimacy and transparency, and even at times a kind of spiritual union. And at other times, there can be varying degrees of ordinariness and not specialness and whatever, and there's all kinds of fluctuations happen, and that's just the way it is.
It's a promise with a no money back guarantee. It's quite the opposite. You'll lose a lot of money when it doesn't work.
As a spiritual teacher, the main problem I began to see is that I began to see that culturally, most of us were programmed, which means we're unconscious of, to believe that in this particular area we were going to find complete, if not spiritual, contentment and fulfillment. And I looked around, and I realized, well, it's just not true. I mean, it's just not true. I mean, there are the rarest exceptions of some couples who are in love with each other, seems to be for eternity, and they just can't get enough of each other. And that's wonderful for them, even though for me personally, it kind of feels a little bit suffocating to be putting all one's attention into simply one other person. But anyway, that might be wonderful for those particular individuals. But generally speaking, it's just simply not anybody's experience. Even though people can have wonderful times together, it's just simply not true. And I began to see that there was this exaggerated expectation that we were culturally conditioned, not only biologically conditioned, but also culturally conditioned to expect too much from the other. And then I remember hearing that song from the movie, looking for love in all the wrong places. And,
right,
of course, I mean, to me, this was a meditation that was happening before I became a teacher, before my own awakening. But because I was thinking about a lot of these things and meditating on a lot of these things and really introspecting, looking within an introspective context about, well, what is the value of this particular area of life really ultimately as it relates to our spiritual evolution? And so what I started to see was that for many people, the romantic and sexual experience is simply what it is. And at its best, it's wonderful, you know, and other times it may be mediocre, but ultimately it's simply a part of life. And it's certainly not the most important part of life. But for me, the most important thing was that for individuals that are interested in enlightenment, that are interested in the evolution of consciousness, and really interested in the evolution of culture, I started to see that unless the individual really began to see that this was simply a small part of a very big picture, which was awakening to life ultimately in its cosmic context, and only when we were actually able to see this particular area of life as a small part of a very big awakening into life itself, I began to see that for most people, with very rare exceptions, mm-hmm. their infatuation with and excessive hopefulness as relates to this area of life inevitably led to disappointment, frustration, disillusionment, resentment, anger, bitterness, until they started all over again.
the idol can't deliver, right?
Yeah,
the idol
can't deliver. Precisely. And also it became an enormous distraction for people because, of course, sex creates karma, and not just because sex makes babies, but whenever we begin to, share the same bed with one individual and sleep together, once, twice, thrice, we are biologically programmed to be attached to each other. So even at a soul level, a bond is created.
Right.
And unless we're actually prepared to consciously accept that bond within the context of really enlightened awareness and spiritual awareness, we find ourselves getting emotionally attached in ways that really digs us in ways we're not prepared for. And this is also in a postmodern context where many individuals from our generation and also from our children's generation have a hard time with growing up, with becoming real adults,
mm-hmm.
which means learning how to really be responsible for all of ourselves. But just to make the simple point here, as I finally came to the conclusion that even though my original influences were Eastern, until my perspective really began to grow beyond that, I thought that I had no doubt that we needed to include this dimension of life as an integral part of an awakened life, but I felt that unless we were spiritually evolved enough and had enough self-knowledge to make this part of life not first, not second, not third, but maybe fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, maybe even tenth on our list of what's important, I felt that unless that had actually happened, unless we could really mm-hmm. have this part of life be less important, infinitely less important, then when we entered into a romantic and sexual relationship, inevitably it would overtake us emotionally and psychologically and become a profound impediment to our ultimate liberation and higher development. So I really feel that that what I advocate is looking for love in spirit. In spirit itself, which has no mm-hmm. gender and in which there is no mm-hmm. other, and mm-hmm. to become very grounded in the awakening to spirit itself, in which there is no other, to such a point that we feel there's really nothing missing. I'm already completely whole. You know, this is the non-dual realization. Mm-hmm. I'm already completely whole. Absolutely nothing is missing. And then from the perspective of that context, then if we would choose to enter into a sexual relationship, it wouldn't be because anything was missing.
Then
I feel we'd be in a position to be able to really pull it off with elegance, with
a lot more grace than it often happens.
With grace, with self-control, with dignity and mutual respect. Yeah.
Right. So you've said a lot, which is just so beautiful. So let me just reflect on it. And my role, and I got a few emails after our last call, you know, where people ask me, like, well, why didn't you put forth more of this or that position? So I just want to say that my role here, and that's part of the elegance of relationship, my role here is actually not to co-teach with Andrew, but to actually facilitate, you know, to get the deepest that we can get from Andrew in this time. So unless there's a particular thing that, you know, kind of needs to be brought up, I want to just kind of, in this dialogue, in this context, just reflect back, right, to you, right, things that are kind of emerging, and then, you know, invite you to go the next steps. That's the particular role. And one of the things about relationships is, in a particular context, a relationship should play particular roles, and we need actually the dexterity and grace to move between roles. So from that place, I want to offer this reflection, Andrew, on what you said, which was very deep and very beautiful, and there's a lot of people on the line, and, you know, 10,000 people have just, you know, thank you to everyone who really signed up for this series, and many of you are listening to this call right now. You know, the way we might be able to reflect back, you know, the teaching that Andrew's offering is something that I've offered to myself and to my students over the years, which kind of gets you thrown out of the room, much like I'm sure you must have felt the reaction from people when they kind of hear this guy getting up and saying, well, actually, make, you know, romance and love number 10, and that's enough to get half the audience walking out. Right? Did he just say that? Like, hello? Like, my whole life they told me this is the most important thing I need to do. This is the measure of my life. And then there's the spiritual teacher, Andrew Cohen, telling me, you know, make it number 10. So it's a shocking thing. I just want to say that to everyone. That's a shocking thing to hear, and it's an exciting thing to hear. And the way in the context of my lineage that I would say it, and I'm paraphrasing something that the Baal Shem Tov said, so I can't make him responsible for it, but I always tell my students, Andrew, right, never marry for love. You marry for love, it's a disaster, right? Yeah. I never marry for love. So they kind of look at me like, oh, my God, like, wow, like he's really flipped. Like we heard, you know, the guy's really, but if you marry for love, it's an utter and absolute disaster. Because if you can't find love, right, you don't actually know what love is. You can't find love in its highest context. You don't actually understand that if you feel that love is basically a body emotion that sweeps over you as you get hit by Cupid's arrow, oops, there it hit the secretary, right, then you're in big trouble. That love actually at its core is a realization of the nature of reality. It's the realization of true nature. And in the intersubjective context, right, love is a perception of unique self, authentic self, however you want to tell the story. It's a perception of the true nature of other. And since the true nature of other is not limited to your special partner, right, the notion that actually you're going to find love in your marriage, or you're going to marry for love, is actually pathetic. Right, that actually love is, you know, we have, as our good Christian friends would say, we have scripture on this, right? Matthew chapter 5, verse 22, right? Love your neighbor as yourself, Leviticus, right? Right, love your, meaning love is actually a perception, a realization of what is, that then is turned towards the other. And the difference between those two paradigms is the difference between night and day. And if I can, with delight, you know, as we do in my lineage, share in the name of my teacher, Sir Joseph Soloveitchik, great, great spiritual teacher who taught in New York for 40, 50 years, right, used to say, right, in response to Heidegger, he was Andrew with Heidegger in 1931, 32, and went to his lectures. And Heidegger would always talk about the dismay when you would look deeply into the eyes of the other, and in the end you would find emptiness, right? You know, you're looking deeply into their eyes, and then the existentialist sees, and there's nothing there. And so Soloveitchik would always say very beautifully, if you look deeply into the eyes of the other, and that's where you begin, it'll never work. You have to first look deeply at a shared horizon, right? Two faces looking in the same direction, and only from that place look at each other, and from that place you actually have a context of a relationship. So I think that kind of dances deeply with what you're saying, which is an invitation to a whole other kind of relationship to everyone listening, right? That actually Aphrodite, right, actually doesn't work. She can't actually do the whole thing. And that if actually relationship comes from ego and not from an enlightened context, then the result is ultimately either disastrous or minimally profoundly unsatisfying. And when the human being is unsatisfied and feels that rising of emptiness, well, that's actually the recipe for disaster. So that's just an incredibly important evolutionary integral context. And if we stop the conversation right here, you know, and we just thought about that for the next 10 hours, you know, we would be happy. So I want to kind of just offer that as a reflection back. And from that place, Andrew, ask you practically, right, as you guide, you know, your students, right, in your context. So do you encourage people, and I think I've heard from a couple of your students, that you encourage people to have a period of celibacy, right, before, right, perhaps that's only particular students as a kind of practice for a period before they engage or are ready for marriage?
Well, some. I mean, these would only be my core students, so there's not that would celibacy is such a
Right, don't be scared. You can go to Andrew's retreat. That's totally fine. It's only for intercourse students, right?
Now, celibacy is considered like such an extreme position by most postmodern postmodern people that it's a word I usually would never bring up in public because it scares people. Because a lot of people.
a lot of people think a call with 10,000 people might be public. Sorry about that.
That's okay. A lot of people think if they don't have sex, they're going to die. And so, no, I mean, so the idea of spirit, the practice of celibacy as a spiritual practice is definitely not a new idea.
Absolutely not.
I mean, except for Jews.
And we'll talk about Jews later, but even Jews, right, yeah. At a particular stage, right? Now, the one who goes to study, right, in the yeshiva, right,
yeah.
Akiva, right, goes to study for actually 5 or even 10 years, in which he actually lives in a kind of celibate context, right, and transmutes that energy until he's ready for that stage. So actually, in the Jewish context, it would be a stage as opposed to a permanent structure, which I think is true in your context as well.
Sure, absolutely. So, how I learned about this and how this became relevant to me was when I was in my days as a seeker, when I was in my 20s, you know, I became a serious seeker when I was 22 and I had my awakening when I was 30. I kind of became aware of the fact, I mean, I was a typical postmodern kid and I felt that this is a period, of course, when I had begun to meditate, I was meditating quite a lot. I began to see that I was very conditioned in my relationship to sexuality, in relationship to the way I was thinking about it. And I very much felt that culture had turned me into kind of a sexual robot, to be blunt. And I didn't like it. I didn't like seeing that. I felt I had no sense of freedom or autonomy, personal sense of freedom or self-control in relationship to this particular area of life. And I didn't like it. And I had been very inspired at that time in my life by the Eastern masters, and I was very curious when they spoke about the experience of celibacy. And so I chose to become celibate for a period of time because I wanted to really free myself from the sense of being a slave. I felt a slave to my own lust and desire. And I wasn't a sexual prude or anything like that. I mean, I'd been in relationships for most of my life, but it wasn't the issue of being in relationship or not at that issue. It was the fact that I really wanted to see what it would be like if I could gain some sense of freedom and sense of self-control and choice. And 3 months into this practice of celibacy and 6 months into this practice of celibacy, I was experiencing ecstasy because I realized that I would see the arising of the sexual desire and then the diminishing of sexual desire. And what I felt was that I felt this sense of freedom, this sense of inner freedom in relationship to it that made me feel giddy with ecstasy many, many times because I realized that not only is it not true that you don't die if you don't have orgasms,
right.
Not only was I alive and well, but I actually felt a place of freedom and autonomy and choice opening up inside me that simply hadn't been there before. And it made me so happy, so happy. And I also, because I wasn't acting on the sexual impulse, I would start to see its impersonal and mechanical nature. Because if you act on the sexual impulse every time it arises, you actually don't get to see that this is simply a biologically programmed impulse that really has no self nature. And it kind of can attach to, as you were saying before, to a particular object. And you can feel, especially if you're a man, you can feel, well, unless I act on this, I might die or I feel like I'm going to die. You realize, well, it's not true. And it's an illusion. It's not really real. And so going through this, you know, 10, 20, 100, hundreds of times, I start to feel this sense of space and freedom open up within me. And after almost 3 years went by, I felt that I actually felt that I was getting attached to the celibate position, and I felt that it was becoming an attachment.
It was becoming an attachment itself.
Yeah, I felt that it was no longer a point of freedom. And then I entered into a relationship with a lovely woman at the time, and that was the end of it. Now, the thing is, I've learned the lessons that I learned through that freely chosen period of the practice of celibacy has served me for the rest of my life. I was about 25, 26 at the time. I'm 54 now. It has served me greatly because I realized that, I'm a married man. I've been married for, 25 years now, 26 years. But as we
I noticed that you invoked Jesus at that moment. I'm just wondering if that was significant. You said Jesus. I'm done.
Well, it's a long time. It's an accomplishment, Mark. You've all
appreciated. It's a huge accomplishment.
You should appreciate it. I mean, especially in our day and age.
Are you kidding? I'm appreciating it beyond belief. Beyond belief.
I believe, and I feel strongly about this. If one is crazy enough to be a spiritual teacher, you know, with a capital T, then one must be an exemplar of what's possible. So the fact that I have been married as long as I have is a statement about what's possible in this postmodern context where so many relationships don't survive. And because we live in a secular context, because so many relationships don't survive, it creates a shared context of cultural cynicism about what's possible. Can human beings really trust each other? Can they really work things out? You know, can they really stay together for higher reasons, or is everybody just out for short term pleasure? So the fact, for example, that I've been able to be married as long as I have, and is a statement about what's possible, especially in our time and in our culture. But just to get back to what we were saying about the practice of celibacy, that it served me because I kind of realized at a certain point, which is a kind of very interesting perspective a lot of people haven't realized, that that being married, you know, assuming one is in a committed relationship, that being married is not really is in many ways very similar to being celibate, because we all know, for example, that as men are biologically programmed to spread their seed far and wide. So that's biological programming for the evolution of our species and also for procreation. So simply because a man happens to be married doesn't mean that he's not interested in making love to many Aphrodites. Okay. But
and there's more than one.
And there's more than many ones.
See, that's why, Andrew, I just have to say, just as a parenthesis, whenever you do a marriage, and as a rabbi. And although I'm spending my time teaching world spirituality, I haven't left being a rabbi behind, so I still perform weddings. And as a rabbi, you always sit with the bride and groom, and the groom's always looking unhappy, but he hides it from the bride because he's supposed to be happy. It's like the happiest, right? So, but, you know, the bride walks out, and you get this, like, kind of furtive look of pain crossing his face, right? So I always take the groom aside, and I say, hey, buddy, like, I know what's going on. He says, what do you mean? He says, I promise I'm not going to tell the bride. She said, what do you mean? What do you think is going on? I said, well, you know, you just said yes to her, but every man knows that in every yes, there's a billion no's.
That's right.
Go, please.
Right now, because so therefore, of course, you know, I'm very interested in the evolution of consciousness, the evolution of culture, and I think that the foundation of the new spiritual culture that both you and I are both so committed to and very invested in giving rise to and helping to co-create with other people is always going to be based upon shared trust. All relationships are based upon trust is the foundation of spiritual relationship and relatedness. It's the foundation of everything. So this also this also relates to, you know, relationships between men and women, and there needs to be a foundation of trust. So in terms of sexual fidelity and sexual loyalty, there has to be a trust that one is going to keep one's vows, you know, and the reason there is because, and the reason why these kinds of vows have been such a foundation stone in the creation of human culture and civilization from the beginning has not really been about necessarily satisfying all the sexual whims of the individual, but it's coalesced to create a condition in which shared culture can emerge. Mm-hmm. So how the practice of celibacy can really help create a strong marriage is, for example, in healthy naturally virile males, it helps one to see the impersonal nature of the biological impulse to want to make love to Aphrodite in her many forms, and beginning to see that it's an impersonal impulse, and that it and be able to take responsibility for it and choose to not act out of it inappropriately, especially if it's going to contradict one's marriage vows. And then what happens is, as that culture gets strengthened, is really putting into practice the highest spiritual values. And at the same time, what happens is here is that one is actually strengthening the bond of marriage, or the whole notion of men of a man and woman being able to be committed to each other and being able to sustain that commitment. And the reason that that's important to me is more than any particular individual, as I was just saying a few minutes ago, because I'm very interested in creating new cultural structures. And part of those new cultural structures is going to have to be one where men and women really are able to trust each other.
Right. No, that's beautiful and important. There's actually so much that you said that's important. I want to pick up on a couple of strands and then turn back with a question, right? Thank you. And I just want to respond just for a second. A couple of emails came to me from Kelly from the webcast. Obviously, people who were divorced saying, like, hey, what about us? Like, we've been, you know, married and divorced a couple of times. So I should say first, you know, between Andrew and I, we've each been, you know, divorced 1.5 times. Meaning Andrew's never been divorced. I have 3 times, so the average is 1.5. So I think I'm probably better equipped to answer that particular question. Right? So let me just say something kind of very seriously here, you know, and other than it, and underneath the humor, the laughter is actually a sacred seriousness, which is that the structure that exists, right, is always, right, what it holds inside, right? We never confuse the vessel and the light. And, you know, and thank God, you know, Andrew's been privileged to have, you know, a deep and profound relationship for many years. And, of course, there's many other people who've been married for 30 years, and they've been abusive to each other every day, you know, in minor and small ways. So from a kind of context of evolution and enlightenment, right, staying in a marriage in a Catholic sense, right, that is to say you can't leave, and it as the idolatrous structure, marriage itself and staying in it, can become an idolatrous structure, which is why Akiva the great mystic said that actually marriage has to always be invested in a flame with, you know, a particular kind of ethic, particular kind of moral context, right? And part of the essence of the moral context is trust. And, you know, along comes, you know, Jesus, right, and says trust needs also forgiveness, right? Because there's no one in the world, no human being alive from, you know, the most realized Ramana, right, to the most realized Buddha, right, to the most realized Moses, who at some point didn't break trust. Because everyone does. It's the nature of being a human being, right? And, of course, there's different levels and different gradations, and let's not equate them. Let's not do a kind of, you know, pluralist, relativist leveling of differences. You know, there's difference between the levels of what which we break trust, but everybody does at some level, you know, from the most enlightened master to the most simple person. And so that's why the Christ consciousness comes along and says forgiveness is actually a real thing. So to actually be able to live in love and forgiveness and to be able to, right, and this is what I want to just add to the two people who emailed in kind of apparently great angst, right, and to be able to enter in peace and leave in peace, right? And we kind of view divorce today, right, as a license to kill, right? You know, you hire a divorce lawyer, right, a person's ego is threatened because the person, it's precisely because of, Andrew, what you were saying, because people make marriage their entire context, so if their marriage didn't work, then obviously they're not working. If they're not working, they can't actually face that. I believe one of your principles that you talked about when we were together in Israel was something like face everything and deny nothing, right?
That's right.
So they can't face that, right? They can't face it. So it must be my partner, and the partner has to be demonized in order for my ego in order to exist. So I hire a divorce lawyer, which is really an assassin, right, in disguise, right, to actually, you know, utterly destroy the person, right, who's challenged my ego, right? So the symptom of who a person is, right, who a person is when the divorce is happening, if it's happening, and we know for many of our listeners, it has happened once or twice or 3 times, and we know that for many of the people in the context of our integral world, right, people that we're close to, who've been in a number of, you know, relationships, right, the question is, how do you leave? Right, how do you leave? Right, and it's in the details of that. Do you try and kind of hide the money, right? Do you try and, right, do you actually leave and be generous and gracious and open. Right? So there's actually an idea which the Talmud talks about, which is kiddushin and gitin. Right? Entering and leaving are both holy. And what we do is, of course, we get married with like this big festival. Right? You know, we spend a ton of money and we got a lot of chopped liver in Jewish weddings. Right? And everyone's celebrating and rejoicing. And then when it's time to get divorced, you're in this dark corner, right, of some hall, and maybe one friend takes off work if you're lucky, or you're by yourself, and then you get drunk that night. That's a disaster. Right? But actually, if there is a possibility of being with someone for a period of years, for a particular reason it didn't work, and then the nature of your enlightenment is tested, right, by how you leave. How you leave. Do you leave in a way that's sacred, that's holy, that honors what you had for the period of time that you were there? Or do you leave, right, you know, from a place of a shattered ego, which then lashes out with all of its ferocity to inflict hurt to remind itself that it exists? So just to kind of set that context, honoring, you know, the beauty of your long-term relationship, and I was actually delighted to be with you and your partner in Israel and saw you together, you know, and, you know, honoring the possibility, right, in our post-postmodern context, that one can actually enter in peace and leave in peace, and that love and forgiveness actually do live together, not in a relative, you know, kind of green conscious sense, but actually there's a forgiveness that's actually a second-tier forgiveness, you know, not the forgiveness of the priest who says that the boys in the Columbine Massacre should be, you know, forgiven immediately just because we have to, not that, not unconditional love.
Well,
but, you know,
one thing I just want to add to what you're saying, Mark, is that I think that the issue here has to do with the context in which the individuals, and, you know, we're speaking about men and women, but of course it could be any particular combination, but in
right,
any case,
right.
it has to do with the context in which men and women are choosing to come together. And in this case, we're talking about in a committed romantic mm-hmm. and sexual relationship. So I think the big reason, or the main reason why so many men and women can't stick it out or mm-hmm. end up in this very dark end to something that seemed to begin with so much promise is that the context in which they came together was probably very small. So there was probably the illusion of the promise of perfection, what I call the promise mm-hmm. of perfection, which is what I was speaking about earlier. And inevitably, you know, that inevitably after 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 6 months mm-hmm. or 1 year, you realize that, you know, you're just with another person, and you're just another person, they're just another person, and you're just, both individuals are probably just as screwed up as they were before they got together. And when all the endorphins have died out, that's just the way it is. Now, the point is, and of course, the great traditions really have a leg up in this particular direction, you know, Judaism
right.
and Islam and Hinduism. You know, they have a great, because then, you know, when you're getting married to somebody in that context, there's a cultural context for the bond. And the marriage in traditional religious context, it plays a role in the
right.
culture itself. And there's a role in which the individual,
right.
so it really fits into a larger context. And I personally, you know, for example, seeing some Jewish Orthodox families, often you see there's a, especially for women, there's a sense of confidence that you often don't find in postmodern women, because they know what their role in culture is, and it gives them a great deal of confidence.
And dignity.
And exactly, confidence, dignity, self-respect,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
personal
yeah, yeah.
power. It's quite moving. The issue here, I think what makes it possible for this to work is discovering a higher context to be together. And I can tell you personally, just speaking very
mm-hmm.
personally and openly about my own situation, I got together with my wife, you know, when I was still in India, and we had been in a relationship. We met each other in India. She's from India. We met each other there. But then after I had my awakening and I started teaching, you know, we had broken up, and then we came back together in this new context. And I remember when she was coming to see me, I was very worried because I didn't want anybody to interfere with this new state. I was in a higher state and a higher perspective I was swimming in. I remember speaking to a close friend of mine. I said, I'm very concerned about the fact that she's coming because I don't want to get attached to anybody. I don't want anybody to interfere with what I'm doing. And my friend pointed out to me very interestingly at the time. She said, you know, you don't really know what's going to happen. Maybe you're just taking a very fixed position here. She was right. So in any case, just to make a long story short, when my wife, when Alka came, we were on at, we went for a walk in the Ganges, and I basically said to her very clearly, I said, if you want to be with me, you have to want this, which means what I had awakened to, and what I was beginning to share with other people. You have to want this as much as I do, and that's the only way it's going to work.
Right.
And I think that.
And she said yes.
And she said yes. And Mazel Tov. And of course, it hasn't always been easy. And
right.
And she has at times forgotten the larger context, but then she remembered, and we're doing well. But the thing is that coming together in a larger context, and I think what articulating what this larger context is, I think, is mm-hmm. really the ultimate meta context for the conversation we're having now. Because as I said before, both you and I are very interested in the next stage of. The next cultural stage, and beginning to, you know, with others, you know, with others that have that same mm-hmm. shared interest, beginning
right.
to articulate what those structures might be like, because we don't want to go back, because we can't go back. We have
right.
to step forward, and the question is, how do we do that? And so as it relates to this conversation today, the way that it's going to, that men and women, that adults are going to find it possible to come together in a romantic and sexual context that's going to be stable and will be strengthening
right.
for all, and also for culture itself, will
right.
be the more clearly we're able to articulate the cultural context in which we're able to express this particular area of human life, that's what's going to make it possible for human beings to really benefit from a romantic and sexual union.
No, that's fantastic. I mean,
and
that's
it makes it
why.
Very creative. It makes it, because this...
Unbelievably creative.
It makes it creative. And I can tell you, you know, I've been teaching for a long time, and I've seen some individuals, you know, come together in this context, you know, and I kind of informally marry people. I mean, in other words, I don't have the legal right to marry people, but I found out there's an easy way I can do that. I'm going to, because I have, especially over the last few years, been performing some of these. And
oh, beautiful.
Yeah, and the context is everything. I have recordings of this and videos of this, of really creating the context. And so for individuals to whom the higher context, you know, giving rise to a higher context is more important than anything else, they don't really have that much trouble in their relationships, because their relationships are no longer the most important thing. Their relationships become troublesome for us when they were the most important thing. But when giving rise to a higher context becomes more important than anything else, you know, then together you're actually trying to create a new world. It's not just about, you know, being together with the other and how much joy and intimacy we're able to experience through sharing each other's company or sharing the same bed. It's, you know, what is it through this union and through our relationship with other individuals that share these same ideals, to what degree we are actually able to give rise to this context. Now, the individuals who were unable to sustain this higher vision, this higher perspective, mm-hmm. inevitably collapsed back into a very postmodern, a very narcissistic, mutually narcissistic relationship that was very banal, very ordinary, and that's all about the individual. And then the dream, shall we say, you know, died, and therefore they may have split up, or they may still be together, but their relationship is no longer a structure for a higher cultural possibility. It's just two people, shacking up.
Shack up,
So the point. So I think that the answer to the question of also for the people that wrote in has to do with. I don't think they really need to be so concerned with maybe what went wrong in the past, because maybe that was inevitable based on the levels of development and the perspectives that were being shared by those individuals. But I think what's important, what's possible now, and I think because most of us don't, a lot of people don't know how can we do this? How can this really work? And I think the way it works is when both individuals want something higher that's more important than any of the individuals involved, that's when all things become possible.
Yeah, no, beautiful, beautiful. I mean, that's the horizon that they're looking at together. And when that horizon's dream, and that's really what, Andrew, you're articulating just so gorgeously, when that horizon's dream doesn't exist and that dream that you were talking about crashes, you know, it dies an ugly death. You know, what did Langston Hughes say? What was his line, right? What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, right? And raisins in the sun don't look good, right? So when that's your only dream, right, and that dream crashes, then you actually don't have, right, the larger dream to sustain you. But the larger dream is really what it's all about, and which is really why. And you've been at a number, you mentioned a number of Orthodox Jewish weddings, right? And there's a Hindu shared context for this, and there's a Greek context and a Christian context, when you basically come together, right, under, let's say in the Jewish context, called a chuppah, right, which is this canopy, which symbolizes the house, but it has no walls. Right? The house is completely open, meaning that the house is actually transparent to culture. And we come together, right, in order to serve, right, the larger culture, which is why we actually break a glass, right, under the wedding canopy, because what we're saying is if we don't break the glass, we're getting so narcissistically involved in our own personal fulfillment at this moment that we lose, right, the Luria writes, we lose tikkun, which would be translating in kind of contemporary language, right, that you've used so eloquently and I've used in a Kabbalistic context, right? If you don't, when you break the glass, you say there's so much pain and suffering in the world, right? There's so much, right, asleep in the world that I actually want my coming together in this union to serve the larger context, and my joy at this moment should overflow, right, to every person in the larger context who's asleep or broken or hurt. And I break the glass to remember all the broken hearts and all the broken, shattered contexts of culture that need to be healed through our union. And
yeah.
So it lives. I mean, it breathes, right, in that larger context, without which it literally suffocates, you know, and dies. So I want to turn to you now with two questions to kind of look at two things together here. And here we're going to have hopefully some creative, you know, tension, because it's a little bit of a particular context. So let's talk about soulmates for a second. You know, that popular word that's, you know, out there in culture, you know, which of course has been trivialized. But I want to offer you just kind of a 1 minute vision of it, and then hear your, you know, kind of spontaneous way into it, which I'm sure is going to be delightful and transformative, right? Soulmates from a kind of evolutionary perspective. Soulmates not in the kind of, you know, narrow, saccharine, narcissistic, non-larger context perspective. You know, soulmates, you know, actually become interesting and important. You know, you may have more than one. Right? There's a very beautiful text that talks about God sitting and making matches. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yoshev U'Mezaveg Zivugim, says an old Aramaic text. God sits and makes matches, and then it says, V'kasha k'kriyat yamsuf, and it's just as hard as splitting the Red Sea. Right? It's not an easy thing to do. Right? And there's this notion, right, that we actually, you know, Claude Lelouch, I can never pronounce French names, so the French people listening, I apologize, has this great three-hour film where in the last second you see the couple meeting, and then you realize that the whole three generations that you've seen in the last 3 hours, thousands of things needed to happen for this particular couple to come together at this particular time, and there's actually a genuine invitation of destiny. So that sense of destiny of a particular couple that can do something particular with each other, right, is something that's very alive in people, and although it can be reduced, right, there's also something very beautiful and important about it, something feels very real about it, right? You meet your partner and you think you chose them. You're sure that you chose them. Sometimes I do, Andrew, with my students, I say, did you choose your partner? And they say, yes. Yeah, of course you did. You had like 10 of the people available. Did you choose your partner? They say, yes. And we'll do it for like an hour. So at some point I'll say, did you choose your partner? And they'll stop and they'll say, no, of course not. It had to be that way. You know, choicelessness. You know, there was a kind of larger something at play. Does that resonate with you? Does that figure in your teaching and in your thought? How does that land on you?
I can say it does seem, it often feels that way. In other words,
mm-hmm.
I mean, because you bring up the whole notion of this, at least partially what you're talking about has to do with destiny, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So the way I look at the whole issue of destiny is retrocausally.
Retrocausal is a great word. Please.
Well, in other words, I say, well, might mean if you say, well, if that seems to be how it worked out over time, then you could say, well, yes, then that does seem to be destiny. The part of the destiny that I just philosophically, you know, have a little bit of difficulty with, because I'm very invested in the whole idea of that change can happen in any moment, and the freedom of that possibility of change means everything to me, and that's why the pre in relationship to destiny is something I'm too evolutionarily biased to be able to give too much credence to the pre-destined part of it. But just adding, just what I was thinking about when you're bringing this up is, and these are some ideas about new cultural possibilities and ideas in relationship to soulmates. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel very close to, you know, to some men, mm-hmm. some to some of my students. I'm very, very close to, you know, deep
right.
soulmate level.
Absolutely.
Transparent, deep, loving, trusting intimacy that's based upon a shared aspiration to do something big and important and meaningful together in the world.
Right.
And the transparency is quite profound. And I also share this with many women. I mean, the only woman I sleep with or have a sexual relationship with is my wife. But other than that, I mean, I think that the problem I have with this, see, the soulmate.
This is
context,
important. This is important. We're hitting something very, very important here.
No, good.
Please.
So I feel that all of those individuals in whom we really share the same aspiration in the context of a profound trust, you know, of a spiritual trust and intimacy that's mutually liberating and empowering and enriching. I experience that soulmate-ness that I think you're referring
right,
to
right,
with
right.
all of those men and all of those women, and I can't honestly say that I experience that particularly more with my wife, even though I for the reasons that I explained before, you know, she's the only one that I share that one particular area of life with exclusively, but otherwise. I think that the kind of intimacy that what being a soulmate would mean, I share with I mean, I can't say, you know, with many, but not with a small number of many people, and the delight and it's a source of delight and a source of confidence, a deep source of confidence and inspiration, that to me means everything. And to me, the sexual dimension of life, you know, is a small part, and I feel it's actually the least important part of deep spiritual intimacy. I mean, it's not really ultimately that important if I really stand back and look objectively at what we're talking about in relationship to soulmate-ness and the ecstasy of real spiritual intimacy. I mean, to me, the sexual dimension of it is really probably the most unimportant.
Yeah, no. This is a really, I mean, this entire conversation is a really unbelievably important and radical conversation, and its meta frame of kind of the larger context is critical. And this piece of it, particularly, right, is really, really important. And here, I have to say, I actually couldn't agree with you more. And I think what you're saying is powerful and profound and needs to be said. You know, in the context that I've lived and in the things that have breathed into, you know, those things that woke me up in the world, chavruta. You know, the spiritual bond, you know, between myself and a study partner, or myself and a partner on the path, right? Whether that's man or woman, with nothing to do with sexuality, it's like what does that have to do with it, right? Is so profound and so deep, and it actually is, right, how Luria describes his relationship to Chaim Vital, right? The enlightened relationship to Chaim Vital is that they are in zivug, they're coupled. Right, they're married. Right, they're married in some real profound sense, and there's no question that Luria and the Luria in, you know, the enlightened master, right, that lives in us, right, didn't think for a second that somehow there was some priority to his relationship to Mrs. Luria, right, you know, in its quality that somehow, you know, overwhelmed or was superior to his relationship to Chaim Vital, and probably the opposite. You know, Chaim Vital was his, he was incarnated to be there with Chaim Vital. Now, it might be that he also has that in his middle world partner, we might call it. And it's sometimes you merit to have your middle world partner to really be, you know, your Chaim Vital. That happens sometimes, but often it doesn't.
What's your middle world partner mean?
You know, middle world partner meaning the person that you kind of get up with and, you know, go to sleep with and, you know, I'm kind of making up a phrase, borrowing it from shamanism, from Ilyada for a second, you know, where he talks about, you know, the middle world, kind of the person that you do life with and that you're on the path together, but that person, you know, might actually not be.
May or may not be.
It's beautiful if it happens, but it might not happen, and that's completely okay if it doesn't because as, you know, as our friend Sally Kempton always says, you know, marriage is sadhana, You know, meaning you're doing the practice, you're doing the work of being ethical and being decent and being good, and you're supporting each other in all the valid and important middle world ways. And it could be that your real partners on the path, your evolutionary partners, are, you know, from your circle of co-teachers or students, right, or whoever happens to fill that circle. So that vision, right, of you know, taking soulmate out of its kind of starry-eyed, saccharine, one-woman context, right, is utterly essential, right? And I think that, you know, just to add something from Luria, you know, with delight here, Luria writes something really, really beautiful. He writes that if you can love one tikkun partner, if a person shares a common soul root with you, who is a partner in your tikkun, if you love one person like that, but you really, really, really love them, right, then that opens up all the love in the world. Right, that through that person, you just, all love is open to you. And if through the person you're close to, you just love them, you're closed to the world, then it's some form of, you know, he calls it yesh, some form of ego in disguise.
Yeah, and another way to just add to what
Please.
We're saying is, of course, the experience of love, at least on an individual level, is, of course, we experience love when we experience, when we allow ourselves, when we feel enough trust to be completely transparent, completely undefended, completely vulnerable, completely authentic, completely truthful, absolutely free from self-consciousness and fear. Mm-hmm. So it's with in the company of those individuals with whom we are able to be that transparent and that authentic and that unself-conscious and that trusting, that we experience the, you know, the ecstasy of human love. And that may or may not include the you know, the physical dimension, the sexual dimension. But as
right.
I was saying before, the sexual dimension, interestingly or not, and you know, and often it's not a popular thing to say, but I said it before, is the more superficial dimension to it. Because it's very interesting. I'm sure many people that are listening today, you know, will be able to see that this is true. That let's say maybe there might be an earlier time in our life when we shared a particularly passionate we had a very passionate sexual relationship with a particular individual a certain period of time in our lives, and through that passion at the time there was the experience of tremendous shared intimacy with great intensity that seemed to be mm-hmm. oh so meaningful, you know, maybe more meaningful than anything else at the time. And then for whatever reason, you know, the relationship ended and individuals moved on. And then as we grow and as we evolve and as we move on, it's interesting that what was shared at that particular time, ultimately you realize doesn't necessarily have much ultimate spiritual or evolutionary significance, even though what happened at the time was a real human experience.
Right.
You could suddenly, maybe you can meet that person maybe after 10 years, after 15 years, after 20 years and realize, wow, you know, we have absolutely nothing in common.
Right.
And so you can see there's something very, very partial and what is it? What's the word when something disappears? Impermanent, yeah.
Right.
There's something, yeah.
Ephemeral.
It exactly is the word. It's ephemeral and impermanent about that particular kind of intimacy. It doesn't mean I'm not saying it's bad or wrong in any way, shape, or the form. I just said that the truth of that level, of that layer, that realm of experience, is that it creates the appearance of depth and the appearance of deep meaning and connection when it's not necessarily true.
Right, right. There's right, the kind of illusion that if you take your clothes off, you're necessarily naked. You can take your clothes off and be fully clothed with a million layers of ego.
Well, or even to be deeply in love and to, you know, on a personal level, experience that level of intimacy and transparency. But because it's not happening within a spiritually informed, you know, a spiritually informed context, even philosophically and theoretically, let alone experientially, even that kind of intimacy can't be held, and so ultimately it's going to disappear like mist. Whereas if that kind of experience can occur within the context of a spiritually informed, philosophically, with Dharma and also with depth of experience, then an experience like that can be held within an enlightened context and seen in perspective, and ultimately, you know, and therefore, you know, maybe become part of something that's ultimately more substantial. I mean, this is never quite thought of that before, but it's kind of it's very interesting. But just to see that the whole nut thing we're talking about here is relationship, mm-hmm. is love, is connection and connectedness, mm-hmm. and to seeing, well, what, you know, what's really more important is the context, is ultimately the context, and how enlightened is the context in which we experience the deep sense of connectedness. That's what ultimately makes all the difference, not whatever the apparent experience is in the moment, because the experiences can create the appearance of meaning, the appearance of depth, when it's not, doesn't ultimately, but it might not ultimately really be the case. Because ultimately, I think the experience of love that really is awake to these deeper contexts and truths will lead to that which lasts and has significance in the evolution of spirit in the world.
Yeah, no, and that is not just beautiful, but here's where truth and beauty meet. It's compelling and important, and it really holds the meta frame of the conversation. And just to describe to people, the kind of conversation we're engaged in here is actually to really enter into a topic with no, you know, obviously we each come with our kind of understandings over the years, but truly be open, right? And so as you heard Andrew, and I really want to do just a pointing out to everyone, as you heard Andrew say about, I think you said about 2-3 minutes ago, Andrew, I never quite thought of it that way before. That's what happens in authentic conversation. In authentic conversation, we actually, the space, which is an egoless space, opens itself up to even a slight evolution, a slight refining, right, an openness, right, which happens when people come into a space where the goal is the evolution of consciousness. The goal is, right, to move to something higher. And so that by itself is delightful. And, you know, letting go of all the metaframes of everything we talked about, if everyone can just kind of notice that, you know, notice the nature of the conversation even beyond its context, right, that's what we call in Aramaic a chavruta, right? It's when people come together, right, with that place of mutual respect to try and engage and get to a deeper truth. From that place, I want to just offer a kind of creative, provocative, you know, respectful, gentle, you know, challenge question. Right, there was a lot of adjectives to describe that. Okay, so here it comes. Right, there's another side to this, you know, and we've already described the side that I'm about to describe where it can go wrong. Right, where eros can become pseudo eros, where the power of the sexual, and of course all the great traditions view creation as being when the line enters the circle, and of course what they were saying is that the sexual holds the power of creation in it, which is why it's so powerful. You know, that's why every tradition kind of views it that way, right? The moment, I think you used a phrase when we were together in Israel, which is a beautiful phrase that I've actually cited in your name before. I think it's something like the initiating energy of the cosmos. Beautiful phrase. You know, it's just a gorgeous turn of language. I want to thank you for that. And, you know, so that's how I would actually describe the great traditions. That's what they're saying. They're saying the reason they're labeling the moment of creation, however you understand that in each creation myth, as the feminine and masculine coming together, right, in a sexual way, they're realizing that the power of the sexual is that which you're calling the initiating energy of the cosmos. I don't mean to be crude, I mean to be funny, it's a big bang, right? I mean, it's that.
No, sure,
you know?
Sure,
I mean,
sure.
That's what it
absolutely.
Is. That's,
absolutely.
Which is why it's so seductive. At the same time, and you've pointed out the seductiveness, and you've pointed out how that which seems personal can really be impersonal, and realizing that freedom and awakening to that freedom. I just want to hold open the other vision and then turn it back to you, to hold open the other vision for a second, and then we've got so many questions coming in, we're gonna step into questions in a second, but let's hold open the vision of the sexual experience, which is beyond ego, right? The sexual experience, which is, you know, what Solomon called sanctum sanctorum, holy of holies, right? The sexual experience that emerges out of a shared vision, that emerges out of an evolutionary context, right? That actually can be realized, right, in, right, a deep expression, right, of sexual merging, right, that perhaps can be not realized in virtually any other realm. And, of course, when we talk about sex, Andrew, you know, it's kind of like, you know, our integral colleague and mentor on an integral side, you know, Ken, you know, talks about what does spirituality mean, and he talks about, you know, the five meanings of spirituality. So, of course, you and I both know that when we talk about sex, what are we talking about? We're talking about reproductive sexing. We're talking about pleasure sexing. We're talking about personality sexing, which is the ego. Are we talking about impersonal tantra? Are we talking about what I call unique self tantra? Or what I've referred to based in Kabbalah as tikkun tantra or bodhisattva sexing, where actually you're coming together in this deepest meeting beyond ego, right, from the deepest place of your awakened self, right? And as you merge, Shiva and Shakti dance with you, the masculine and the feminine come together, kutshabrihu shchinte, right, the shchina, right, and the masculine and feminine divine actually marry in you, right, and you're actually affecting a tikkun, a fixing in the cosmos on every level, all the way up and all the way down, and you offer, right, the depth of your, not pleasure, not a spasmodic, you know, orgasmic 3 minutes, but it's not just a whole body orgasm, it's a whole soul, up and down, unique self, authentic self, right, coming together in this highest way, the specialness of that, the vision of that, right, the call to that, right, which isn't available, you know, has nothing to do with age, has nothing to do with, you know, the state of the body. And I sometimes think that I'm passing back to you, and I apologize for the slightly long run-on paragraph, so apologies for no punctuation.
So what's the question here?
So the question is, right, can we also hold that out to our students, right, also as a vision, as something to reach for, just like we reach for, right, deep states of enlightened consciousness, both from an impersonal and personal perspective.
Well, sign me up.
You know, it's like the Harry and Sally thing. I'll have what she had.
Right? Right. Well, no, I don't think anybody's going to say no to what you just described.
Right. And so,
Why would one?
exactly. And it's important to have that in the conversation. You know, it's that people don't misinterpret what we're saying as, oh, wow, these guys kind of missed it. Really, sorry, it didn't work for these guys, Andrew and Mark. But actually,
well, no. But I mean, what you're describing is wonderful and it's beautiful. But I remember having in one of my published dialogues with Ken about this, and he even. And to say this respectfully, he even did a better job than you describing that the experience.
No way, I reject that completely.
You just did, and so I say, well, of course, you know, Simon is wonderful, but there is what you're describing is within the realm of possibility in terms of our shared experience of sexual intimacy, but. We just have to get realistic about, you know, what actually really does happen most of the time versus what can happen sometimes.
Right, and yes, for sure, and a yes and, right, and I think my description was better than Ken's. You know, tell Ken that. I'm going to send him an email. was that the ego or the enlightened self talking? Not well. That's pretty easy to figure out. Okay, so but to really hold. To hold both places together, and to hold
sure.
that actually, you know, sexuality actually can be itself, right, an opening, right,
at
to that
best.
Which is beyond
at
ego.
At its best, for sure. At its best,
at
absolutely.
An opening to beyond ego, yes. And we need to teach, right, you know, the same way we need to teach people the practices of, you know, of moving beyond ego. We need to teach people, you know, the ethical practices of living in a moral context. We actually have an obligation, you know, to our students, and we all have an obligation to ourselves, and we take our mistakes and turn them into destiny, right, to actually teach what does it mean to be a great lover, and it's got obviously nothing to do with sexual technique, right? Being a great lover is about bringing, you know, your full, enlightened, awake being with all of its sensitivity, with all of its, with everything that it is on every level up and down, right, into that relationship, and sex is, right, as Luria has said 1,000 times, it's a practice. And then the notion that we actually, it's kind of a funny thing, right? We have a manual for everything, but for sex, we just have a technical manual. And sex, of course, at the gross level, right, gross level meaning not as in bad, but as in, you know, the way we use it, gross, subtle, causal, right, is limited. But when you actually raise it and it begins to move to the subtle body and the causal body, and you actually begin to actually practice in a real way that as a sacred practice, right, that you actually do work on and you actually develop the same way you develop any other sacred practice, and we can't skip that. We can't skip that. So I'm glad that's in the conversation. And I've now gotten like so many emails from the executive producers which say, take questions. So everyone, right, please, you know, welcome to ask questions. If you're interested in studying with Andrew before we take questions, please go to Enlighten Next. It's enlightennext.org. Andrew, not .com, right, I think? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Enlightenlex.org, and you'll see, you know, Andrew's dialogues, Andrew's retreats, right, Andrew's writings, and you can really take whatever the next step is for you that you feel drawn, or even beyond what you feel drawn, step beyond it, you know, and be able to kind of study and be with Andrew. If you'd like to study, right, in the integral context that we're developing now, right, you know, at Integral Life, join us at Integral Spiritual Experience, right, coming up out of Sylmar, right, this coming New Year's. It's our second Integral Spiritual Experience. It's a great integral evolutionary gathering. And Andrew, thank you for supporting the gathering and being in this Future of Love series actually twice, right, which is just utterly delightful. It was last year just, you know, utterly beautiful experience as we developed unique self, and now we turn to unique relationships, and much of the Dharma that you've heard here is going to be at play there in different contexts, and we'll be there together with Deepak Chopra and Warren Farrell and myself and Diane Hamilton and Sally Kempton and Ken and, you know this wonderful, wonderful panoply of just really, really beautiful people and really kind of going inside and creating a sacred context of we, a shared evolutionary space. And Andrew, this year, right, you know, you and I had talked about it earlier, but hopefully next year, right, you know, we'll have talked enough and I'm going to somehow persuade you and you'll come and join us, which will be delightful.
I would love to do that.
Yeah, that would be just, you know, utterly.
What we've been talking about today, these are actually important ideas in terms of how do we actually live. How do we actually live this? This is very important territory. Everybody's very curious about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is really important. It's very important.
This is really important. Yeah, and you're, you know, and everyone, you're listening to two people who have really different predilections about this, right? In other words, you know, Andrew, I think as we left Israel, you know, and lots evolved in my life over the last 4 years, but as we left Israel, we kind of noted, you know, we have great shared space and then kind of very, very different, unique, authentic selves. And, you know, I lean towards, which is, of course, why I gave the description, right, you know, of great Eros, right? I lean towards that area, you know, have been both, you know, a great practitioner of it and made mistakes in it, right? And I've, you know, learned a lot about it. And so that's one place of sharing. Andrew's sharing from a completely different place, you know, from a, you know, a very, very unique and singular and gorgeous place. And those both of those together create a shared context, which actually should provoke you. And I hope there are people who are provoked at home. You know, good teaching should comfort the afflicted, but absolutely afflict the comfortable. So if everyone's been comfortable the whole conversation, you know, it's been a disaster. So
yeah, another way to put that is a phrase I use in my teaching, which is called creative, which is, and I think this is obviously on target for today, but it's creative friction. So all evolution happens through creative friction. There's negative friction, which is destructive, and creative friction, which gives rise to emergence. And this happens, of course, at the level of matter, level of biology, which is how life, of course, is life. It comes through creative friction. Lovemaking is creative friction, but also the evolution of ideas and the evolution of our thinking and cognition also comes through the creative friction, the rubbing up against the ideas of the other within the context of a shared creative aspiration. And that's thoroughly positive and absolutely evolutionary.
Right. And you know, when it's absolutely positive and evolutionary, that's the place that also becomes delightful.
Shared delight. Because when it's working at its best, then as you were describing earlier, something emerges, something arises that didn't exist before.
That's
and then everybody benefits.
That's right. And you know, and just to, and as we take a couple of questions here, just for everyone to kind of feel into that you can actually be in love with many people, not in the kind of, you know, endorphin release puppy love way. Why would you want to do that? But you can be in love with many people in the sense that love is this deep perception of the true nature of other with whom you share an evolutionary journey, and our love lists are just way too short, and our understanding of love is way too narrow. So expanding that, you know, and because, as Andrew said, this is the God in culture, right? You know, as he was describing, and I gave it that image, but it was his, you know, deep and gorgeous description, right? To actually shatter that idol, you know, to be an iconoclast, right? To clasp that icon actually gives birth, right, to the potential future of love. So anyone who's on the line, *7. We've got, you know, Kelly's emailing me, say, skip the line, take webcast questions, there's too many. But I want to give at least one opportunity, Kelly, to anyone on the line to press *7, right? You can press *7 and ask a question. So does anyone want to kind of pick that up? And Kelly's emailing me and telling me now that actually the Star 7 thing is not working right now. Okay, so let's be kind of on the ball here. Let's take the first webcast question. First webcast question, right, comes from John in Mobile, Alabama. He says, Andrew, are you proposing the Shakespearean notion that was addressed in Romeo and Juliet of being in love with love? How does one love the spirit if not through the spirit of the other? So John asked that in the beginning, so you've actually partially addressed that, but let me put it to you in any case. And then he says, otherwise, is that kind of love nothing more than abstract love, right? Is that what you're describing?
No, what I'm describing is not abstract at all. I'm speaking about being in love with spirit first and foremost. And then of course, because you know, what happens is that as one actually awakens to enlightened awareness, one begins to fall in love with consciousness itself more than one is in love with any particular individual. And one finds that those individuals who actually awaken to consciousness, one finds oneself uncontrollably attracted to. But then one's not really in love with the individual. There's no particular individual that you're attracted to, but it's the consciousness that's emerging through that individual that one feels irresistibly attracted to and compelled by. And that is a very different kind of experience of love than anything that we could call personal or romantic or that's ego-based at all. It's being in love with consciousness. And when we do awaken in a deep and profound way to consciousness itself, one finds oneself, irresistibly attracted to the awakening of that same consciousness in other people. And then, of course, one is in love with the spirit itself, that one without a second, in oneself and in the other.
Yeah, no, utterly beautiful. And, of course, you know, Andrew, when you use the word personal, this is, we're not going to dive into that thing, but I would say that the way Andrew is using the word personal, he means personal in its small sense, right? But as you said in our dialogue a couple of weeks ago, we could actually agree that this higher place is actually intensely personal, right, in some way. I think those were actually your words.
Well,
I want people to be really clear, not to get confused about that.
If it's intensely personal in the sense that it would be one with spirit as the non-dual absolute, then I would say yes.
Right. No, I would say yes. And, you know, and God having an Andrew experience, right? My evidence for unique self, Andrew, is you.
Right?
But, I mean, that's actually true, right? In other words, it's completely unmistakable, right? So, yes, it's consciousness, right? Yes, it's the one, but it's an unmistakable, utterly unique and singular expression called Andrew Cohen, you know, of which there's one and no other, right?
You know,
so in that sense,
Mark,
you know.
Mark, we need to have a part two because, you see, we don't disagree as much as it might appear. But I think there's more, there's the nuance in this. It needs a little
more. We're going to get now.
I know.
Yeah,
but it just needs more shared exploration because there's more nuance that I think is of value here to go into together.
No,
we'll both find interesting. Yeah, okay, good.
Received. And what Andrew's actually saying very, very politely and implicitly is, Mark, don't raise a big topic at the end of the dialogue like you did last time that we don't have enough time to get into. So I completely accept that very, very gracious emendation, and I appreciate the grace of it. And just to say, just to thank, you know, on behalf of everyone, Andrew, to thank you for being with us. It's
my pleasure.
Been, you know,
my pleasure.
Just delightful.
It's been great,
completely great. And just, you know, what emerges in the conversation, right, is just the utter and radical sincerity to get to clarification, right, and just to be able to be together with, you know, with you in that kind of conversation beyond the unbelievably important content is by itself, you know, Shabbos. We're in Sabbath now, which is Oneg, which is delight. So that's my Sabbath delight. So thank you very, 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 very much. And I look forward to more and deeper as we unfold both in unique self and in integral spiritual experience and in all of the contexts that you're developing with such incredible energy and gorgeousness in the world. Thank you, Andrew.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
Shalom, shalom.
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 Shalom.